This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting against ageism in the workplace and the marketplace. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review, all things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Jeremy Logan for Libby Znaimer. A look at a spot-on name to describe the current state of the digital services that dominate our lives and reimagining long-term care in Ontario as the province struggles to bolster its bed count. But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. Getting a flu shot, RSV jab, or the shingles vaccine is a well-established preventative health measure, but other reasons are also emerging for older people to get vaccinated. It's called off-target benefits, meaning the shots do good things beyond preventing the diseases they were designed to avert. A recent analysis published in the British journal Age and Aging found reduced risks of dementia after vaccination for an array of diseases, most notably the flu and shingles vaccine. Research is also underway investigating the effects of the shingles vaccine on heart attacks and stroke, and the COVID vaccine on cancer survival rates. It's a dance class with a difference. Cognitive Grooves is a twice-weekly class for those with mobility issues and part of a study at Hamilton's McMaster University to explore how movement can improve mobility, brain health, mood, and overall quality of life for adults 60 and over. The majority of the dancers use a cane or a walker and say getting steadier on their feet is important since they often don't go out in the winter for fear of falling. The study, founded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, follows participants for 6 months after the classes end to see if their use of the healthcare system has been reduced. As of January 1st, the Kentucky plant that makes Jim Beam, the largest maker of bourbon in the United States, will be on pause for a year, and Canadians may be partially to blame. The sudden decline in bourbon sales may be linked to the Trump tariffs. All but two Canadian provinces, Alberta and Saskatchewan, have halted the sale of alcohol from the states. Previously, Canada was considered the industry's biggest export market. Also, consumer behavior is changing, with young people not only drinking less, but when they do indulge, tend to favor higher-end products. Given the continued economic uncertainty, insiders say the pause at Jim Beam is both a sign of how bad things have gotten for the industry and a harbinger of more shutdowns to come. Former prime ministers and cabinet ministers in France are looking for alternate modes of transportation after losing the perk of chauffeurs for life as the government looks to rein in public sector spending that has ballooned out of control. President Emmanuel Macron's government says the cost-cutting measure is evidence that even the elites are tightening their belts. The 24 chauffeurs, employed to drive many of the now elderly former ministers, and the 24 bodyguards hired to protect them, have all been assigned other tasks. The cost of the program was around $12 million Canadian dollars per year. Barry Manilow has been forced to cancel a series of concerts this month after being diagnosed with lung cancer. The 82-year-old singer-songwriter had been fighting bronchitis for months when his doctor ordered an MRI and the tumor was discovered. Manilow, behind such 70s hits as Mandy, Copacabana, and I Write the Songs, is scheduled to have surgery but is not expected to need chemo or radiation. He began his career writing jingles for commercials, then became the musical director for Bette Midler. Between his self-titled album in 1973 and 1982, he notched 9 top 10 singles. Manilow has also won a Grammy, Tony, Emmy, and been nominated for an Oscar. I'm Jeremy Logan, and those are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. Pop-ups on websites, clickbait stories in your newsfeed, ads in your Instagram feed, and AI slop galore. The phenomenon has an eyebrow-raising name coined by technology critic and author Cory Doctorow. Fight Back guest host Tasha Kiridan caught up with Cory to unpack this troubling trend.
It's easy to blame people for making bad consumption choices as though voting with your wallet ever solved anything and it wasn't just a big conspiracy by billionaires to get you to vote with the one thing they have more of than everyone else. It's also easy, and I think somewhat true, to blame the ketamine-addled Zucker Muskian failures who run the internet because they are terrible people. But I think the real blame has to lie with the policymakers who created the policy environment in which those terrible people would make much more money by being as bad as they could. So, for example, in 2012, Stephen Harper's Tories passed the Copyright Modernization Act that makes it illegal to modify your own technology, which means that you can't like add an ad blocker or a privacy blocker to your phone. It means that if Facebook takes your news away, you can't reverse engineer the Facebook app and make a new one that puts the news back in, which means that no Canadian company can go into business competing with Facebook, replacing the feature that they ripped out. It means that you're just at the mercy of these American companies. So I think we really have to put the blame with them. After all, they're the ones who are supposed to be working on our behalf, Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk. You know, they operate on behalf of their shareholders and the false gods they worship. But, you know, we do have someone who's supposed to be in our corner.
You say this process unfolds in three phases. What are those phases for NSifying our internet?
Yeah, so there's a pretty typical pathology of, I don't know if I'm allowed to say the word. Am I allowed to say the word? Yeah. You know, the CRTC is not the FCC. Like, you can like, if the CDC lets you say the word, then you guys should too. Anyways, it's a word that sounds like inflitification, but there's a sh in there, and the sh goes in a word that means pooping.
Yes.
So that word, the process by which it unfolds is pretty characteristic. In stage one, you have companies that are good to their end users, but finding a way to lock those end users in. And once the end users are locked in, it means that they can't leave if the platform gets worse. And that's the signal to make the platform worse, to take away value from those users in order to give it to business customers. And the business customers get tempted in because they're getting some of the value the end users used to have, and they get locked in too. And once they're locked in, you go into stage three, which is where you take the value away from the business customers and the end users. You claw it all back for the shareholders and the investors. You leave behind the kind of minimal, kind of homeopathic residue of value that'll keep users locked to the platform, businesses locked to the users, and the whole platform turns into a pile of poop.
I always find it interesting that, you know, we actually do have power. Our currency is our data, right? And we give up this data in exchange for, you know, that 10% discount that pops up when you go to a website. If you order something from them, if you just give them your email information, we hand over, we do barter our information also for some forms of commercial gain. So is it the question of simply that we're not striking the right bargain? Could we strike a better one? Has it gone too far? What exactly is the balance here is that's being struck?
Well, it would be great if we actually could bargain. And, you know, when we're on open platforms, we can't. So the web, it runs in browsers. Browsers are open technology and they can be modified by third parties. So not just the company that makes your browser, but anyone else can make a plugin for your browser. And 51% of web users, the majority of web users in the world, have installed an ad blocker that also gives them more privacy when they use the web. And I work for a nonprofit called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We make an extremely popular blocker called Privacy Badger that everyone should download and use that defends your privacy while you use the web. It's the largest consumer boycott in human history. But when Harper's Tories in 2012 passed a law making it illegal to reverse engineer and modify things, they set it up so that no app user could ever do this. So the majority of web users protect their privacy when they use the web. No one has ever installed a privacy blocker for an app because under Bill C-11 of 2012, the Copyright Modernization Act, it's a crime to modify your own phone to protect your privacy while you use it. Now, the practical upshot of that is if you're designing your website and you say, well, maybe I'll make the ads a little more obnoxious and invasive and privacy violating to see if I can make more money, you have to think to yourself, well, you know, if I make 2% more money and 20% of my users install a blocker, I come out behind, not ahead. So I better not do that. But if you've got an app that you're thinking about making more obnoxious and invasive, why wouldn't you make it as obnoxious as possible? It doesn't matter if those users say, well, that's it. I'm going to try and install a blocker, because when they search for how do you block ads and defend your privacy with an app, the answer is it's been a crime since 2012 in Canada to defend your privacy while you use an app. An app is just a website with the right kind of IP to make it a crime to defend your privacy while you use it, which is why every company is so incredibly horny to get you to use their app instead of their website so they can steal your privacy while you're using it. If it was a bargain, you could say no, right? But you can't say no.
So is the solution,
if you use the service, they take your private data.
This is fascinating because I've resisted downloading a million apps because my phone also didn't have the capacity. And then, you know, it always happens and you get clogged, you get a new phone. But are you saying that it's actually smarter to transact with companies on the web, on their website, as opposed to downloading the app? Is that something we should consider?
Absolutely. Although, again, I want to counsel that this is not consumer protection advice, right? Consumer protection doesn't come from consuming really consciously. It comes from making it illegal to steal from you, right? Trying to protect your privacy and have a better internet experience by very consciously choosing your technology is like trying to save yourself from wildfires by recycling very conscientiously, right? It's true that you should recycle and you should choose products that give you a better experience and so on, but don't kid yourself that you're voting with your wallet. Right. If you want to fix this, we should maybe ask our leaders, rather than flushing billions of dollars into AI, a product that loses money every time someone uses it, maybe we should revise the law that makes it illegal for us to fix American technology. And then Canadian companies could go into business fixing American technology and selling those products all over the world, especially because the reason we have that law, the reason we passed that law in 2012, is that the American government threatened us with tariffs unless we passed that law.
In 2012.
And then we hit tariffs anyway.
So in the last minute we have left here,
we're
not going to change that law overnight. What can people do to protect themselves concretely against their loss of privacy right now?
Get involved in a movement. Join openmedia.ca. Join the Electronic Frontier Foundation at EFF.org. Get involved as a citizen and not as a consumer. You're better than being just an ambulatory wallet. You are a person who has political agency and is deserving of moral consideration whether or not you're spending money. It's not because you're not paying for the product that you're the product. It's because they can get away with treating you as the product that you're the product. Moral consideration is not a customer loyalty perk. It's a thing that firms give you if they have no choice. We have to take away the choice to rip you off and degrade you when you use the internet.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know what? This is a great way to start off the year. If you've got any New Year's resolutions, there you go. Get involved in the movement. Thank you so much, Cory Doctorow.
Hey, thank you.
That was technology critic and author Cory Doctorow. I'm Jeremy Logan, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. Coming up, as the Ontario government seems to be missing the mark in its goal to add thousands of long-term care beds in the province, some say there's a better way.
You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting for financial security for our seniors. Find out more at carp.ca.
The COVID-19 pandemic forced many Canadians to confront a difficult reality. For thousands of older adults, long-term care homes were not always the safe, supportive places we assumed they were. In Ontario alone, the pandemic exposed deep challenges, from outdated buildings and staffing shortages to questions about how we care for people as they age. In response, the province launched an ambitious plan to modernize long-term care. However, Ontario is falling well short of its goal to add tens of thousands of new or upgraded long-term care beds by 2028. I spoke with Dr. Samir Sinha, a geriatrician with Sinai Health and the University Health Network, professor of medicine at the University of Toronto, and director of health policy research at Toronto Metropolitan University's National Institute on Aging to explore the state of long-term care in the province and what can be done about it.
I think a large reason for the gap that we're seeing, and that there are a number that are kind of under construction or in planning, but when we even look at the numbers from last year, only 6,700 actual beds had actually been opened, you know, in that way. So it's been a very, very slow process. And I think part of the things that have gotten in the way have been the pandemic itself that really kind of put a spanner in the works, if you will, in terms of developing and building things. But also the costs of building new beds have skyrocketed as well. So any sorts of construction costs, whether it be hospitals or long-term care homes, for example, the costs have skyrocketed because prior to about 2018, the previous kind of when the government first announced its modernization plan at that time, it was offering around $250,000 to build a bed. So it was actually giving the money to these operators to say, here you go, we'll give you the money to build a home, and this is the price we'll pay per bed. Now they're willing to pay about $570,000, so over twice that amount to build a bed, and that's still not enough in the eyes of some developers who say they might even need as much as $1 million per bed. So the cost of actually building institutional care settings has absolutely skyrocketed, and at the same time, if you ask any Ontarian where they aspire to age, I don't think many of them will tell you that they aspire to end up in a long-term care home. And the real, you know, kicker in all this is it's far cheaper to provide care for people in their own homes. And so you could think of, instead of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, even $1 million to build a single bed, that could buy a lot of home care and a lot more care in people's homes that would allow them not have to even go to a long-term care home in the first place.
Regarding what the provincial government calls modern design standards, as it relates to upgraded long-term care beds, with this initiative launched, well, years ago, is it fair to say that some of these new standards might already be outdated?
Absolutely. So we have to be really clear that the modern standards that the Ontario government is putting all this money behind are standards that were established in 2015, so 5 years before the pandemic hit. And the current standards, for example, say that we can allow up to two people in a room, for example. But during the pandemic, we realized that when you have more than one person in a room, that's a recipe to spread infection. So, of course, we've now outlawed the previous practice of having up to four people in a room. But, you know, current modern hospital construction in Ontario, after the SARS pandemic, said, nope, only one person to a room. Why aren't we also holding that same standard to our long-term care settings when we also know from the pandemic that having any more than one person to a room is a recipe to spread infections that much more quickly? So that's just one example. What we learned during the pandemic and the resulting recommendations from the Australian government, you know, the United States, you know, kind of leaders, and also the Canadian National Long-Term Care Design Standards that came out after that, were suggesting that we should have small household-like models. And when you look around the world and we're talking about, well, what do we mean by a small household-like model? What we're talking about, you know, you can build these in large settings with multiple households or small, like literal households that have no more than about 12 people to a household. So 12 rooms with individual bathrooms that share one common base, you know, common living room, kind of kitchen area that creates a real more household feel. That's basically what the design standards now say we should do, where we, again, give people their own rooms, but also, you know, group people in smaller clusters together.
Now, your recent report, There's No Place Like Home, calls for reimagining how we provide long-term care in Canada. And your report cites evidence that Canadians overwhelmingly want to remain in home-like settings for as long as possible. How do we balance that with, well, the reality of some needing 24-hour care?
Absolutely. So again, the key is that, you know, we know that all of us want to stay in our own homes for as long as possible. But we know that's not always possible for people. But, you know, number one is we fund home and community care adequately. Because currently in Canada, about 10% of new long-term care admissions every year are seen as being ones that could have been avoided if we had adequate home and community care services. So right now we know we have hundreds of thousands of older Canadians who report having unmet home care needs. And you can imagine that just puts strains on them and their families. It means they have no choice but to move into an institutional care setting. So that's the first thing that we need to do. And then when we talk about care settings, where certainly there are patients of mine that I say, it's time we move into a long-term care home setting, where you can get that 24/7 support. In those cases, they shouldn't be big institutional settings. They should be small household-like settings. The other key thing in this model that we've learned, and there's great evidence around, is that if you actually adopt a more innovative staffing model, where instead of having, you know, 10 different people coming into a setting, one person to clean, one person to deliver the food, one person to do the laundry, one person to do your care, all these sorts of things, that introduces a lot of people into a setting that can cause confusion, a lack of coordination, a lot of disruptions. And so what they've actually found through a number of studies is that when you actually change the staffing model, so you actually have the person, you only have a few staff members in one of these settings, and what they're assigned to do is help you do your care, but they also cook the meals, they also do the laundry, they do that. So you adequately staff these settings, but it allows the staff to actually have more one-on-one time with each of their residents because they're doing all the tasks, not just certain tasks. It allows them to build better relationships. The residents love it. They get more hands-on and face-to-face time with their caregivers. The care providers actually like it because it means that they're doing more meaningful and more natural work. And what we've actually found is that these more modern models of staffing have actually allowed staff to actually be more satisfied, more likely to stay, you know, stay in these settings and do this important work. And well, most importantly, we've seen rates of infection significantly fallen. So during the pandemic, when we were able to study this model of care, which exists in some places in Canada and in a number of places through the U.S. and Australia, et cetera, we saw much lower incidence of COVID-19 coming into these homes and significantly lower numbers of deaths. So not only is it better from an infection prevention and control standpoint, it's a much better experience for the people who are living there. The resident experience is much better, but also for the staff, they much prefer working in this sort of model. And that's why our report talks about what should we be building in Ontario for the beds we need to build. We need to build small household-like models, and we need to actually adopt this more universal care provider approach, and that's the way we need to move forward. And we can do this. This is the key thing. We absolutely could do this if we put the political will around this.
Dr. Sinha, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
That was Dr. Samir Sinha, a geriatrician with Sinai Health and the University Health Network, professor of medicine at the University of Toronto, and director of health policy research at Toronto Metropolitan University's National Institute on Aging. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Jeremy Logan for Libby Znaimer. Thanks for joining me today. Be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Zeev Hadi, with technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Znaimer.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.